Hello and welcome to another episode of La Pausa Pod, where it's myself and Jamie talking through La Liga action. This week we had a big game at the Mestalla, Valencia drawing 2-0 with Real Madrid. We're going to jump into the stats corner first, talk a little bit about Segunda before we finish off with that game at Mestalla. Pretty interesting tactical battle there, and Valencia, who we had been talking about doing a podcast about, we were hoping that they wouldn't just fall flat on their face. They absolutely didn't. Ruben Baraja has them going really nicely. They're overachieving at the moment. But yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. Firstly, though, Jamie, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks. How are you?
Good, good. What football were you watching this weekend, or what did you have your eye on?
Saturday was a bit of a marathon. I think I did three games on Saturday, and then yeah, I've just been filling in the bits ever since. Caught up on Leganés Eibar last night, so we could talk about the game you went to in person. So, yeah, first Segunda game I've watched for quite a while, but lots of familiar faces and players that I'd already known pretty well.
Yeah, when I bought a ticket for it, and then I checked the La Liga fixtures, I saw Athletic Club were playing Barcelona at the same time, and I figured I'd have to go back and watch that later, and I was hoping that didn't turn out to be a party that, though. I was listening to the radio on the way home in the car, but I got all, and then I went back and watched it. So, yeah, Barcelona dropped points against Athletic Club. Disappointing for them. I think in the end, the race for top four, I suppose the only real winner, there was no real winner in it. Real Madrid, maybe.
Yeah, I'm sure Real Madrid will say they should have taken 3 points, but yeah, I'm not sure whether we want to get into that one.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll start off with Stats Corner. Jamie is after compiling a list of stats, well, three, that he found interesting and that caught his eye. So do you want to kick us off with the first one there, Jamie?
Yeah, first one is just from Saturday's game in Getafe, and you might be able to add some context to this, but pretty terrible conditions in Madrid at the weekend. We had snow at Vallecas, and it was awful, kind of rain, sleet at the Alfonso Perez. And yeah, Getafe came out flying. I think the weather early on was probably much to their favour, with Las Palmas having come across from the Canary Islands and sun into that monsoon. Yeah, monsoon conditions, and they're trying to play out from the goalkeeper, and Getafe are swarming them. They went in 3-1 at halftime, Getafe, and then the stat we have from this game is that it was the first time since November 2017 that Bordalas's Getafe have been 2-up at halftime in La Liga and failed to win. So in the 13 previous instances when they'd been 2-up at halftime, they'd won every single game, so this was a real rare collapse from a Bordalas side, and full credit to Las Palmas, who got stung quite a lot in the first half for the way they wanted to play and build from the back, but eventually worked their way into the match and clawed their way back for a very good point.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about low blocks. I was particularly taken by how well Valencia did, so I've been reading about low blocks. I just posted a tweet on my own account there from Billy Carpenter. He was talking about mid blocks and what their goal is and how they achieved that goal. And when I mentioned about Valencia hopefully not falling on their face on Sunday, on Saturday, we had planned on doing a podcast about Getafe, another team who plays a mid block, very aggressive when they do press. And they ended up falling on their face against Barcelona. So, yeah, they are going through a strange kind of moment with Bordalas, trying to maybe be a little bit more offensive than they have been in times past. But, yeah, on the weather on Saturday, it was brutal here in Madrid. Yeah, the Rayo Vallecano-Cadiz game was suspended for 10 minutes. The referee called a halt to it. It was, like, haily, snowy. Yeah, it was a weird one. And it's been cold in Madrid recently, last few days, but it usually doesn't rain that heavily, and they just say like a very on the Greece, they're a very grey day, and yeah, they can't handle that kind of lack of sun here in Spain. So brutal. But yeah, on to the next stat then. Sorry,
I was just going to say, I think you could probably compare Las Palmas's performance before and after, depending on the weather conditions. When the weather was at its worst, they were terrible, and then when it calmed down a bit, they were much the better side. So I think it was Canarian weather psychology at play there, along with the very relevant tactics.
The Rayo, back on the Rayo game versus Cadiz, that was suspended in the second half, and Rayo were winning 1-0, and the game was suspended, and they came back out, and it really not that the style of play particularly suited either team. I just think there was a real crappy conditions, but Cadiz ended up getting a late equalizer, and I'm just thinking about the Rayo Vallecano's last three games. They played Real Madrid, and then they played Girona, and then they played Cadiz in those conditions, and the new manager Iñigo Perez just hasn't really gotten a chance to catch a break. We haven't really got to see them at what I think they will be their best. So it's going to take a couple of weeks, but I just hope that he can get it going. Yeah, just things haven't really been going his way. So let's see in the next couple of weeks how that works out. So the next stat is Real Sociedad revert to the Rambo against Sevilla. The last time that they played a 4-4-2 diamond was April 2023. And of course, that's the first time since David Silva left the club. This was a loss for Real Sociedad, but it was also a very disjointed performance, I thought, which is to be expected given the fact that they rotated so many of their starters. It feels like when you take maybe two starters, three starters max out of a team, a well-established team, a stable team, you can get away with it maybe. But to take 5-6 out, it just... Against the Sevilla team, they were quite aggressive, and they won a lot of the duels at home. I just wonder where this Real Sociedad project is going now. They play PSG tonight in the Champions League, and obviously they've got their eye on that one, and they're thinking maybe they can turn this around. It's only 2-0. They're playing at home, and let's see how that goes. But I just wonder now where this project is going.
Yeah, it's a difficult moment for sure. I think it was probably one of the worst performances I can remember in Alguacil. But again, like you say, with the changes that they made, kind of understandable. The 4-4-2 diamond in this case, yeah, when you use it without David Silva, turns out it's not quite as good, surprisingly. But I just found it interesting that they used Olasagasti in the number 10 role instead of Zacharian, who was the player I assumed would fill that role for the creative impact. But again, they used it different to the way that they did a year ago when it was their standard formation, where they weren't really trying to build advantages through the lines. They had the diamond and the numbers in the middle, but they used Olasagasti as more of a runner to try and occupy the three centre-backs for Sevilla. So it was basically him inside of Sadiq and Silva, and it just never really worked. And on the defensive end, Real Sociedad suffered in a way that you don't really see. Although En-Nesyri scored twice, our good friend Isak Romero was absolutely brilliant in this game. So yeah, it was one of those moments where Real Sociedad rotated at a time where I think Sevilla are actually looking like a very decent team again. So yeah, tricky timing on that one.
Yeah, and a couple, Hannibal played in the centre midfield alongside Soumaré and then Oliver Torres, not known for his aggression, but it was a 5-3-2 they played in, and Hannibal and Soumaré in particular really, really aggressive and kind of quite dynamic too in where they were moving around and picking up all of Real Sociedad's runners, because like you were saying, it was kind of hard to figure out. Zacharian was coming in off the right, and yeah, they obviously the full back problem for Real Sociedad. So they played Adam Burrow as the right back here, and Kieran Tierney. We spoke about that at the start of last year. about how they needed more from their fullbacks. They obviously agreed, went and bought Traore, who's been really good. But when he comes out of the team, there's a drop-off that's notable. And then Kieran Tierney, what they thought they would get from him hasn't really materialized because of the injuries. And then they signed Javi Galán, and he was rested, presumably with an eye on PSG. So it's kind of hard to get any fluidity there. They're going to have to solve that fullback problem, I think. Do you think that continues to be an issue?
I think when you play the Diamond specifically, yeah, you need a lot from your fullbacks. And in that case, they didn't really get a lot. Like you said, Tierney's been injured. It seems unlikely they'll be able to keep him next season with the price that they'd have to pay for him, I think. And Aramburu is obviously a very young guy, just come in the team. By all accounts, he's a really good, a really good squad player, trains super well. Alguacil loves him apparently, but again, he's not an immediate attacking force from fullback. So again, yeah, I think they will sign Javi Galán in the summer if they can do that. And then you would probably look for an extra right back as well to back up Hamari Traore, because we know he's not a young guy either. He was a guy they brought in for immediate performance and he gave that. But when he goes out, it's quite a drop off for the moment.
You said that it was one of Real Sociedad's worst performance under Alguacil. And I was kind of thinking that while I was watching it, and maybe not necessarily bad, but definitely not what they generally look like. It wasn't fluid. There was a lot of moving parts that maybe that was my own not being able to make sense of it, but it just felt like it was disjointed. And when I mentioned earlier about where this project goes, I would imagine Alguacil, I don't know, I mean, I think they've probably given up on the league now in terms of obviously pushing for top, or sorry, no, they haven't given up pushing for top four, but I would say they will accept where they are in the league and accept taking the loss here if they can turn the game around at PSG. But if they don't turn that game at PSG around, they've lost in the Copa del Rey semi-final. They are fighting an uphill battle to make it into the top four, and they're knocked out of the Champions League. Relatively successful year in terms of what they did in the Champions League, but they'll be disappointed. And what I was saying about where the project is going, I wonder, when you look at the attackers that they have, when you look at some of the pieces of the puzzle that don't quite fit and haven't really fit, I wonder, will they think now is the time maybe to sell one or two of the bigger pieces in order to build a squad that is more competitive? Because it feels like when you, and I'm thinking about this in terms of Athletic Club versus Real Sociedad. Athletic Club, it feels like they're building towards something. They've just signed the guy from Braga, Alvaro Giallo, and it feels like there's momentum the way Real Sociedad was last year, we'll say, and they're building towards something. So I hear a lot of talk about Nico Williams leaving, different players being signed by Premier League clubs. But it feels like, just like Zubimendi said last year, I'm happy here. I think that's what the Athletic Club players will be thinking this year. They'll be saying, no, we're building towards something here. Whereas with Real Sociedad, maybe some of those players and the club might be thinking, okay, now is the time to change this around. Do you think that might be the case this summer?
I just don't see them doing anything drastic, really, Real Sociedad. I think they're a really sensible team. Even this season, knowing that they were going into the Champions League, they didn't go out and sign a massive players and bulk the squad up, which you might look back and say was a mistake, but it's just not the way they tend to do things. The young players from the academy, they fill quite important positions behind the starting 11. So you see guys like Turrientes and Olasagasti playing. You see Pacheco as the kind of first line centre back behind Zubeldi and Lenormand. I just think playing in Champions League, Copa del Rey, La Liga has pushed the squad to the limits this season. And yeah, it's unfortunate because I do find it quite admirable that Real Sociedad, they have that philosophy of they want, I can't remember the exact percentage of the say now, but I think it's something like 60% homegrown and the rest sourced from outside. So, yeah, I think it's just one of those things where Real Sociedad have had a Champions League campaign where we have to say in the group stage they were brilliant as well. I don't think we can forget that if they go out to PSG, that in the group stage they were one of the best teams in Europe this season. But yeah, just balancing all the competitions has been pretty brutal. And for me, once they're out of the Champions League, which I'm assuming is going to happen tonight, I think they should be finishing sixth this season. Their form should pick up and I expect them to overtake Real Betis. I mean, whether that happens is another thing, but I think that's what the demand should be until the end of the season.
Okay. So you answered my question there. I'm getting a little bit crazy here, thinking Real Sociedad need to push their chips in, take advantage and push for whatever the heights that they can reach. But you're thinking, no. Easy does it. Finish sixth, fifth, fourth every second year, third year. It's fine. So luckily I'm not in the boardroom making decisions or I'd be selling everyone to buy, I don't know, some 120 million striker. But I guess that just comes from a place of frustration with their striker situation. It feels like they've got a couple of different players and none of them. Andre Silva hasn't. I was actually kind of annoyed with Andre Silva not celebrating his goal. Mate, you don't score that often. Celebrate. You played Vissavi on loan for like 10 minutes. Like, just celebrate. And yeah. If I was a professional, I'd be celebrating against my former club. I don't care. But anyway, that's a kind of a side point. So moving on then to another club who I think need to take a serious look at themselves in the mirror this summer is Atletico Madrid. The once unbeatable Jan Oblak is starting to look mortal all of a sudden. He's conceded the most goals from outside the box of any goalkeeper in La Liga this season, with the eighth already his most in a single league season for Atletico Madrid. Diego Simeone was talking before the Real Madrid match before, and it was interesting. He was talking about how he's got his Atletico team and where he wants them to be. Things have gone sideways since then, but he was talking about the different players and he was saying about how Rodrigo De Paul now has a presence in the team and this, and he said about Jan Oblak, and we'll have to see what Oblak has left. And I thought that was interesting because it doesn't translate perfectly into English, but basically what Jan Oblak can offer us now, kind of. And it was almost like an acceptance that Oblak is coming to the end of what was a dominant place amongst the top goalkeepers in La Liga and even in world football at one point. Obviously, that's dropped off a bit. So I wonder, on the Oblak question, what they're going to do there. Obviously, he's their number one. His level hasn't fallen off yet, where it's a massive issue. But just in general, do Atletico need to reinvent themselves in the summer?
What, in general or from the keeper position?
Well, I saw a report saying that they were going to buy two defenders in the summer. One of them is Gabriel Paulista. So he's already in the squad, and then one more, I guess. Is that enough? Because obviously Oblak conceding those goals is one thing, but there's an issue here with the personnel on the field too.
I can't
speak to each individual goal outside the box, but the defending hasn't been up to scratch. And I'm just wondering, do they need to have a think here about how... about the striking that balance between going all out attack, which Simeone 2.0 or Cholismo 2.0 has been about, not all out attack, but far more attacking. And then they've kind of forgotten how to defend.
Yeah.
Is that something they need to address?
It's tricky because you don't know which way they're going to go from this point, because everybody agrees that Atletico need better central defenders in a pure defensive sense. But at the same time, you watch guys like Savic in possession with the way that they're trying to play from the back, and you're thinking, what's the replacement going to be for Savic? Is it going to be a pure Savic-style defender, somebody who's younger and got more potential, or is it going to be somebody who is a ball-playing specialist? I don't know. Maybe they go out and sign Mika Marmol from Las Palmas or something to replace Hermoso, who seems to be on his way out. But again, how do you, if you stick with the three, what is the breakdown going to be in terms of ball playing strength and pure defenders? But it seems like I'm not hopeful that Atletico will have a lot of money to invest in the squad, unfortunately. So, yeah, to be fair to Simeone, I think what he gets in the transfer market isn't or hasn't quite been up to scratch of late when they expect him to compete for the title and be good in the Champions League. So, it's a tricky one. With Real Madrid presumably getting Mbappe this season, I don't know, maybe Atletico think the title might be off the table next season if they can't strengthen significantly, which I think they can't. Well, which I think they won't be able to. So, just interested to see which way they take it, really.
Here's a proposition for you now as the sporting director of Atletico Madrid. Jan Oblak is their top earner. Sell him for whatever you get for him now. 10 million to Valencia, we'll just say. No, not Valencia, whoever. I haven't thought this through, so bear with me. They sell Jan Oblak. And they sign Alvaro Valles. Is that something that you'd be interested in?
I think it'd be a solid move because, again, while Atletico's ball-playing revolution, we'll call it, has taken place, Oblak is still pretty much a negative with the ball at his feet. Only problem with Oblak, I think, is that he's contracted to 2028 as it stands, so I'm not sure how much moving on from him will be at the front of their mind. But again, it's Oblak feels like he's now in that place where he's not a keeper who wins you points. He's not a keeper who costs you points, but he's just in that in-between zone of where it's fairly average performance when before we were used to him genuinely winning Atletico points throughout a season. So yeah, tricky to... I don't think they'll move on from him, but again, it's one of those things where if you're trying to find reasons for Atletico to get back to winning a title, I don't think their keeper is a real plus point for them anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's, as always from Jamie, very sensible. I agree with that. And I think that the gains that they could get from bringing in a ball-playing keeper could offset a lot of what you'd probably lose with the shot stopping. Potentially, but then again, Oblak isn't even providing that. So, but like you said, he's one of the top wage earners. He's not in his best moment. So who's gonna? And he's got a contract until 2028. You were saying, and so I mean, how do you move on? And it might not even be a talking point. So anyway, moving on to the Segunda Division, I went to Leganés Eibar on Sunday night and got to see a pretty dominant performance from Eibar. I can't say I'd watched much of them during the season. I'd watched them when they're on, catch some highlights, but I hadn't really sat down and focused too much on them. But I was really impressed by them. Opta's expected points model only has them 13th in the table. They're one of the biggest overachievers this season. Their expected points is 39.7, and they've actually got 49, whereas Leganés, they're also overachieving. They're currently sitting first in the table, but we have them 5 points fewer than what they have. So they have 50 points, and our expected points model has them at 45. Well, from what I saw on Sunday, Leganés could hit a rough patch, and yeah, they didn't convince me at all, to be honest with you.
Eibar, you definitely look at and think they have more firepower and better individual players in attack. But yeah, it's interesting that Eibar are so far down on the expected points table. Obviously, we know we reference stats a lot, but we are not totally bound to them, as in expected goals are the be-all, end-all. They are a guide to use rather than absolute fact of where teams should be in the table. But again, like we were speaking before the podcast and saying, you know, Segunda is so much about timing and the moment you find yourself in from kind of March onwards at this point. So again, I think it's 3 points that separate the top four in Segunda. And I saw last night that Elche won 3-0 against Alcorcón. I think it ended 3-0. Might be right. I'll have to check that after. But anyway, Alcorcón's manager said that he thinks Elche will win Segunda from this stage. So again, it's incredible the amount of teams that are up there and the dynamics that will change from between now and the end of the season.
Yeah. According to our expected points model, Elche are the top team. So that's interesting. On a couple of performances, like the firepower you were saying, Bautista is not like a target man number nine. He's not overly fast. He's a great finisher, and between him and Stoichkov, they've got like some really nice combinations there. Stoichkov, technically really good, loves getting behind the defensive line when Bautista drops out, and then you add in Mario Soriano on loan from Atletico Madrid there, who's just so tricky in the number 10 spot. And then behind them, who I was most impressed with was Mateus Pereira from Barcelona Athletic, previously of Barcelona Athletic, and Peru Nolas Guain, who is just an animal in duels, just kept going. They were 2-0 up, 10 men, they got the man sent off, and he just kept going. He just, every single, and it's a lovely balance, defensive Nolas Guain. It's a really hard name to say, by the way. There's so many vowels in there.
We'll call him Peru.
So, Peru, yeah, Peru. But Peru is just an animal defensively, and Mateus Pereira, just a touch of class that a lot of teams don't have in the Segunda. And like you were saying about the just catching fire at the right time, if you have the right quality and you're in the fight, when it comes down to it, the business end of the year, as the cliche goes, you're able to ride that wave straight into automatic promotion possibly. And I just think with that squad and with the players and with the experience at the back mixed with some youth, I just think that Eibar looked really impressive. And it'll be interesting to see now. So yeah, we're kind of coming into the business end of the year, as I was saying, and we're going to be keeping a closer eye on the Segunda division.
Yeah, I just wanted to say on Nolas Guain as well, because we're talking about athletics so much these days and the young players coming out of the academy. Nolas Guain is from Athletic as well, and you can just see the similarities between him and a guy like Prados, you know, Vivian, all these players who come out of Athletic, and they're just so competitive. They all just seem to be monsters in individual duels. And yeah, they've signed him permanently now at Eibar, and if his game can come on as it is in possession, then he looks like he's going to be a really good central midfielder going forward. And Matias Pereira has always been a real classy player. His passing range is probably among the best in Segunda. So if they come up this season, I've no doubt those two will be pretty solid options in the team.
Yeah, the yin to his yang. It was Peru, exactly like you said, the mentality, you could see it in him. He just bites, and you could see that in every single duel. There was one ball where it was kicked up towards the Leganés keeper, and he just started chasing it down. It was like a kick return in American football. They have a guy called like a gunner, and he just goes. And I was like, what's he going to do? He's not going to get there, but he just chased. It was like he was just an animal for work. He just wanted to be active. It was great. So, yeah. And then Mateus Pereira, the opposite. You could see, like, he's the kind of player with so much class that if things probably weren't going his way, or that you could probably imagine him not really feeling this. But when he's on it, he can just dictate a game, which is what he did in the first half against Leganés. You're just looking at him going, he's going to decide what's going to happen here. It's that guy there, the base midfield, he's going to decide the rhythm of this game and whether or not Eibar win this game. So, yeah, really, really good performance from Eibar. Disappointed from Leganés, and we'll see where they go from here. And now moving on to the big one at the weekend. It was Real Madrid versus Valencia. 2-2 it ended. And we want to focus this segment of the podcast on Valencia in particular. Ruben Baraja has worked wonders, really, with Valencia this season. They're probably not going to qualify for Europe. They're not going to be relegated. But this is a team that a lot of people had pegged for relegation. They've been selling off a lot of their players now for the last few years. And it just felt like this summer was a turning point. It was like they had reached the bottom, and there was nothing else to sell. They'd sold pretty much all the players, and it was going to be a team filled up with youngsters. But as it turns out, you can win something with kids, and they didn't win this game, but it was really impressive. The 4-4-2 from Valencia out of possession caused Real Madrid all sorts of problems with their build-up, chance creation, and went 2 ahead, and were probably in the end a little bit lucky to come out of it with a point. But still, overall performance was really good against a Real Madrid side who had Jude Bellingham back in and pretty much a full strength 11 based on who they have. Obviously they're missing Courtois and Militao, but they weren't really missing any of their key players that they currently have available.
Yeah. I thought, obviously, there's a massive controversial ending in this game where Real Madrid think they should have won it 3-2. Don't want to talk about it too much. I think Real Madrid have grounds to be a little bit annoyed with it. But yeah, we'll leave it at that anyway. I thought 2-2 overall on the balance of play was a pretty fair result, to be honest. Valencia had that chance in the second half with Diego Lopez inside the box where it flashes across and Lunin makes a good save. I think if they'd have gone, 3-1 up at that time, that would have been, it would have been the makings of an absolutely classic Valencia performance and built on what Baraja has done this season. Like you said, they're a team we've wanted to talk about this season. It's just trying to find the right time to do it because, like I said, we wanted to do one on Getafe, how good they've been this season. They went to Barcelona with a high line, got destroyed, so felt a bit less relevant. But yeah, we'll dig into a bit of what Valencia do now as the season as a whole, not just against Real Madrid. And yeah, talk about in possession, out of possession, players we've enjoyed most. So yeah, should we start on in possession?
Yeah, we'll start with just a couple of stats from their season overall. They played a 4-4-2 19 times and a 4-2-3-1 7 times. They've got the youngest starting 11 in La Liga on average, 24 years, 175 days. And they've made the second fewest starting 11 changes in La Liga this season, behind only Girona, who made 40 changes, and Valencia played 44. So, young team, really consistent, and fairly stable formation, we'll say. So, yeah, in terms of in possession, what we saw from them was how a lot of this hinged on their fullbacks getting forward and when they won the ball. So, Dimitri Fulquier and Jose Gaya drive forward to make it 4-2-4 with Pepe Lu and Javi Guerra in staying in the middle just to beware of defensive transitions. But they're the ones who add the width and add a little bit more depth. And they don't really have a lot of the ball. So it's not like they're built around what they do in possession. It's more about what they do when they win the ball back. It's what they do when they can press and turn the ball over high up the field. And with players like Javi Guerra and the speed they have on the wings, they can transition into attack pretty quickly too.
Yeah, that's, I would say, the most recognisable thing you see from Valencia is quick attacks where they're not, when they win the ball back, it's not, well, all right, we'll put 6-7 passes together and reorganise. It's get the ball to Pepe Lu, get it wide. let's put some speed into the game. And that's probably what I like most about Barakas Valencia is I feel like they're built in the image of a team that he would have played in himself, kind of in the 2000s, where it's this is not a team that have been, you know, have become or have been taken by the wave of possession play. Baraka understands the way that fans want to see Valencia play at Mestalla, where it's, you know, fast transitions, aggressive. Not one aspect of the game where they're, you know, particularly dominant in, but they're just a really balanced team. And if you look at the playing styles graphic that we have on Optanalyst on the La Liga hub, you know, they're neither, you know, a pass-heavy team nor a pure counter-attacking team. They sort of sit in that middle zone with teams like Rayo and Athletic obviously do it very well from there. But yeah, it's you just get the sense of Valencia that there's no real part of the game where they're uncomfortable. Even when they're defending, whether they're playing, whether the defensive line is high up or further back, it feels like the 4-4-2 block always moves together in the pitch. And again, yeah, the defensive record, just to say, is it has been really good this season. Fewest shots faced per game in La Liga, at just under 10. Third best XG against, excluding penalties. So yeah, this is just a really well balanced team on both ends. And yeah, the fast attacks are obviously the strong point, and what they get from the wingers, who are both young players. If we're talking about Diego Lopez and Fran Perez, who've come up from the academy, really good stuff from them. We know it wasn't intentional 100% to bring in so many young players, but the way that Baraka has put the pieces together has been brilliant.
Yeah, when you said earlier there, let's start with in possession, I should have stopped you because I think everything that they do comes from how they play out of possession, which is, like I said, the 4-4-2. I just posted a tweet there about Billy Carpenter, who writes Edu's Barbecue on Substack. He's an Arsenal fan. He writes a lot of kind of football articles, tactical theory and stuff like that. And he's got some pretty nice personalized metrics and stuff like that. But he was writing about how to beat a mid-block, and he was just saying what the best characteristics are of a mid block, what the goal is and how they try to achieve that. And it's watching Valencia playing and what they did to Real Madrid, it's just perfect in how they did it. So what you try to do is you condense the pitch, which is what they did. They avoided access to the central areas. It felt like Jude Bellingham wasn't in the game. Toni Kroos couldn't get a foothold in the game. Fede Valverde was struggling to figure out where to be and pick up the ball in central areas. Camavinga couldn't really get involved, and you conserve energy, which is what we see in that they're not pressing wildly. But having said that, when the opportunity comes to press, they're so well coached that they know when to do it, and this is key in terms of what Sergio Canos did and Fran Perez on the other side. So it felt like Lunin was just standing there with his foot on the ball, and Valencia were like, we're not going to press you now because you're just going to tear us apart. And it felt like Lunin was hesitant to send a ball out to either Tchouaméni or Rudiger. He was kind of looking for something central. Valencia weren't giving it up, so they had to go to maybe Tchouaméni and then out to Carvajal. And as soon as that ball was played out to Carvajal with his back to goal, Canos pressed up, and that's where the second goal came from, in that Carvajal had no options because Canos was just chasing down them, and their sort of pressing cues were excellent, and that's how they were able to get into advantageous situations. And when that didn't work, obviously that's a great strategy to press in when a player is receiving the ball, put them under pressure, grand. But the problem is a lot of teams tend to get pulled apart by that, because a team like Real Madrid is able to stop, pick out a pass, and all of a sudden your shape is all gone. But with Valencia, you didn't see that, because Javi Guerra and Pepe Lu knew when to sit and hold their positions, and they also have so much. This is where the youth comes into it, I think, in that they're able to recover when they do press out. They're able to recover, and they're so well coached that they know, okay, this chance is over. I'm going to step back, and I think that that's what we saw. And I think, like, one of the ways to beat the mid block is something that Toni Kroos brings, but he just, so you pass it out, you switch the ball, and then long ball over the top. But we didn't even see that, because Kroos was dropping into the center of the back three, and that pass was just never on. So I just think it was a mid block masterpiece from Ruben Baraja in this game. Would you agree with any of that, or is Ranton that I said there that you don't agree with?
No, I definitely agree. The way that Valencia mixed it up, I think, was the key in that they knew when to drop off and shut down the space, and they knew when to jump up and seize the chances to win the ball back. But overall, they just did a first half, especially, they just did a really good job of keeping the ball trapped on one side. We saw it perfectly in the second goal, like you said, where when Carvajal receives the ball, I think at that point he's kind of just got to shell up and try win a throw in or something, because there is no pass on for him. Valencia have latched on everywhere, and from the moment it left his foot, you were thinking, "Oh my God, what have you done?" Because there was no pass on. You know, it was one of those moments where you have to just submit and try win a throw or a free kick or something. But yeah, I was surprised that he brought Javier Guerra into the midfield instead of Guillaume on, but it was a clear bet on adding extra athleticism and legs to jump out to be aggressive when the ball went backwards, and they did have chances to push up and win the ball. Guerra did a really good job there, because surprisingly, he's had quite a difficult time recently. If you've not been watching Valencia weekly, or you kind of dipped in at the start of the season and saw him, he scaled the mountain. He came out red hot out of the gates, looked like an unbelievable player, and then he had a dip, which is natural, because when you come flying out of the youth team like that, there's always going to be a point where you come down the other side. So it was a pretty important game for him, actually, and he looked like the Guerra that we saw when he first came out, where he's obviously an incredible athlete, but again, really good bits on the ball. And yeah, we texted actually in the second half, or you said, I wonder why he's taken... wonder why he's moved Guerra up into the number 10 position. And I watched it back, and it was the first time all game, really, that Bellingham managed to run off him. Baraka saw it, and he was like, "We're not allowing, we're not allowing one more run from Bellingham to go unchecked." So Guillaume came on, Guerra pushed up. And it was a very small lapse in concentration from Guerra. Not to say that it was a huge error, but it just shows you how dialed in Baraka was with the out of possession stuff, where it's like, we cannot give him an inch of daylight. As soon as that happens, we're making changes.
And that's what that comes back to the point about conserving energy. When you look at the changes he made, he changed out his two wingers who are really important for what they're trying to do. He, as soon as he saw that, he pushed Guerra up and brought in Guillamon, and just to try to keep the freshness. And obviously they're fairly normal changes. It's not like he was doing that out of the ordinary there, but I think he was really conscious of that energy perspective and that real, because with Real Madrid coming at you looking for a late equalizer and then a late winner, it's going to take utter, because in that piece about Billy Carpenter, I can't recommend it enough. He was talking about how the team has to play with a shared brain. It's more about mentality than anything else. And that's what I was so impressed with. They moved in unison. And as soon as Baraja saw Guerra, no, he's not connected to the team anymore. In terms of, he just can't, we have to bring him out. And that's understandable, because he was the key to breaking on counters. And it is one area of his game where he probably needs to, he gets a little bit too excited carrying the ball because he's so leggy and he's got so much pace that he thinks he can go by everyone. And he's just, his control can be a little bit loose in that sense. But breaking on the counter, once he gets that right, he really is going to be a proper force to be reckoned with. And just on the point about how they pressed and the pressing triggers, and that one about Carvajal getting caught on the sideline, Hugo Duro, who is a kind of a weird striker in that he's not going to score you 20 goals a season, but he works so, so hard, and he just pops up in important positions at important times. What he would do is he would loop around, and he was sitting then on Tchouaméni, and that became a non-option. So, and he's one of the standout performers here, and I think in many ways Hugo Duro is very much emblematic of this team working in unison, young, hard work, maybe lacking in overall quality in general, but just being willing to muck in and get results. And I think when obviously they have Andre Almeida coming back now, and we're talking about how they played 4-2-3-1. I wonder, is that something that they're going to maybe explore, or at least have in their locker coming out? Because Andre Almeida is a player who I thought was going to take a step forward this season. Obviously, injuries have curtailed that, but he's a player who you don't really leave sitting on the bench either.
Yeah, it's funny because it feels like their identity as a team has shifted a little bit in the time that he's been injured. Last season in the early part of the season when they had Guerra and Almeida in the team, that felt like they had more ways to kind of build through the thirds and they were a bit more associative. Obviously, that is Almeida's game. Whereas now he comes back into a team that are 4-4-2, really good in transition, want to play fast. It's not really Almeida's game. But again, he is one of their most talented players, a player who last season I thought might potentially get a move because of his quality in midfield. I don't know precisely how he'll come back into the team. But again, any options are really welcome for Braca, because it's not as if he's got a wealth of options. And just to mention one guy as well, that Diakabi obviously suffered the awful injury. Speaking of options, now he's gone out, it's probably going to have to be Cenk, who comes in alongside Mosquera. And I think that is going to be one thing that is really going to test Braca now. Can he keep that collective solidity together? Because I don't think he fancies Cenk at all as a defender. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if he brought in Jarek, the other young guy, to play alongside Mosquera. Sustaining their defensive performance with Cenk in the team, who is not really a convincing defender, not overly physical, certainly nowhere near Diakabi in that sense, I think it's going to be tough. But yeah, Mosquera started the season as the young kid on the block coming in to partner Gabriel, and now he's the front line first choice centre back. And what a season he's having too. If he can maintain his performance and keep Valencia's defence solid once now Diakabi is gone, then yeah, serious player there, candidate for player of the season for them for sure.
Yeah, Diakabi, just absolutely brutal injury. And he's gone for, I mean, it could be a career ender, that one. There was a doctor on the radio earlier talking about how it's the worst injury you can suffer to your knee. And the first thing is making sure that he's able to walk again, which is absolutely just horrific. But he's 27, Diakabi, and Mosquera is 19. And if Cenk comes in, he's 23. So it's going to bring the average age down even further. And it would mean, obviously, you've got Fulquier and Gaia on the sides, both experienced players, but it just brings the average age down now, and it will be interesting to see what Braca does. And yeah, on the other players who have stood out this season, Pepe Lu is obviously a pod favourite here. Mosquera, Duro, Mamardashvili, another youngster, and Diego Lopez. And I just think it speaks to how well they're coached. And like we were saying, that it wasn't a plan for this to come together so quickly and so fluidly. But a lot of these players have really increased their stock in over the last 6-7 months.
Yeah, massively. It was, like we said, not 100% intentional for all these young players to come in and totally remodel the image of the team and the club. But it's, we always joke about a manager knowing the club in terms of finding his way into jobs. But in the case of Baraka, it's certainly helped. And at a difficult time, he's understood how the team should play. He's understood the ways to make them a collective. Just you wonder how far up the table they can finish now. If they go any higher than this, then he has to be a candidate for manager of the season.
Yeah, so I think we'll leave it there. We've spoken enough about Valencia, all the stats we covered, and a little bit about the Segunda. But yeah, until next week, it's adios.